Okay, well, welcome everybody. This is our ninth session of a forum for a tipping point, and the title of today's session is The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. Our guest speaker, of course, as you all know, is Charles Eisenstein, and we are very, very fortunate and honored and excited to have you with us, Charles. So welcome.
Thank you, Brad.
We're going to start with a guided meditation, and we'll try to keep it a little short today just because I know we have a lot to talk about and share. So let's just all begin with some deep breathing, really long, deep inhales and long, deep exhales, and make noise if you want to. You're all muted, so except for me and Victoria and Leslie and Charles. So you guys can press star 6 if you want to mute yourself. And let's stretch. Stretch your arms up to the ceiling. And slowly bring them down on an exhale. Slowly down to your sides. And do that a couple of times if you want to. When you reach up to the ceiling, stretch your fingers wide and high. And yawn if you need to. And make a loud exhale sound if you feel like it. Deeply relaxing and let go of a lot of stress and tension to do that. Okay, so let's all just get centered now in your chair or on the floor, lying down or whatever position you're in. Just keep your spine straight, but be comfortable. And let's begin with some relaxation. Remember to keep the breathing going, the inhales, long, slow inhales and long, slow exhales. And let's start with the scalp. And just relax your scalp. Visualize a warm liquid pouring down over your scalp like honey. And as it flows over your body, let it relax all the muscles that it touches. Over the brow, over the eyes, relaxing your face, your cheeks, your jaw. And allow your lower jaw to separate from upper jaw. Just let your jaw hang loosely there, which does something to the wiring of the brain and allows you to stop thought and relax. And let that liquid flow over your neck and shoulders, relaxing everything as you go. Relaxing your upper arms and your lower arms and your hands. Relaxing the chest and the upper back, the abdomen, the whole torso, the pelvis, genitals, the buttocks, the upper legs, and the lower legs, relaxing the ankles, and the feet, and the toes, deeply relaxing and letting go. And so let's all do that one more time. I will be quiet and just scan your body to release any tension that's held anywhere. And so now let's focus on the crown chakra and let's open the crown and visualize it as a funnel opening up and out. The 1,000-petaled lotus on the top of the head. You can visualize all those petals opening and opening and opening. and allow the golden white light to rain down from the celestial realms down into the crown, into the aura, funneling down into the body. Take that beautiful warm feeling of the golden white light and bring it down through the Shushumna, through the central core, all the way down through the body, down through the torso and the root, and down into the legs, the feet, and down the arms and the hands. Let it fill you up, this beautiful, warm, blissful energy. Very luminous. Filling up your hands so much that the light comes out the tips of your fingers. Filling up your hands so much that the light comes out the palms. And filling up your feet so much that the light comes out the tips of your toes. And filling up your feet so much that it comes out the soul chakra, the bottom of your feet. And now let's bring our attention all the way down from the crown, down the Sushumna, down to the root chakra. Put your attention at the base of the spine, at the root. And that in itself is very relaxing. Just to put your attention there helps you to let go and relax. And let's open the root. And take your grounding cord down into the earth, as far as you can go, down to the center of the earth if you can. And wrap the grounding cord around the core of the earth. And just feel your being anchored to the earth. Feel your groundedness. Feel the support of Gaia beneath you. You're tethered to her core, that iron crystal at the center of the earth. And now let your energy mingle with the core of the earth. And bring that energy from the core of the earth back up into your body through the grounding cord, all the way back up to the root, through the soles of your feet, up your legs, and let it move up your body. And as you move the energy up through the Sushumna, as it passes each chakra, feel the groundedness and the balance in that chakra. Up past the second chakra, past the third chakra, up to the heart, up to the throat, up to the third eye, and the cave of Brahman, and the crown. And now one last piece. Let's put our attention in the cave of Brahman, the place right in the center of the head, few inches back from the third eye and between the ears, where the pineal, pituitary, and hypothalamus glands reside. And let's just all focus our attention there for a few moments. And as you all know, I'm sure you can feel when you're there because you can stop thought. It's a magical place where you stop thought and connect with the cosmos. And as you do that, as you put your attention there, feel yourself expand. Feel the magic quality of that place. If you can find it, feel the connection to the all that is. Feel your oneness with everyone on this call, even though we're separated by vast physical distance, especially our friends in South Africa and Europe and Brazil. Most of us are from North America. Just feel your inner connection. There is no time and space in this place, in the cave of Brahman. So let's consciously merge at this level and become of one mind. And feel that deep soul connection that we all share. And let's all hold this together. I'm just going to say a brief prayer, an invocation, before we get started. We call on the Great Spirit. We call on all the beings in the invisible realms who are surrounding us with love and support right now. All the angels and guides and masters and teachers, ancestors. We invite you into this call. Please surround all of us with love and support and with light, divine light. We thank you for your presence. We give such great thanks for this opportunity to be together today and share our love and share our hearts. And especially to have our beloved friend Charles with us. We give thanks for this opportunity. We ask, please guide our conversation in the highest way, into wisdom and love, into light, into the unity, into our connection with Gaia. Let us feel that and know that at every level of our being. Blessings upon this call and upon everybody listening, participating, with deepest gratitude. Amen. Aho. And so, lastly, feel that love space in the heart. Put your attention in the heart chakra, right in the center of the chest. And just feel our hearts merging as we begin our call. Feel the love. The one heart that we all are. And as we do this, we recognize we are of one mind and one heart with no separation. And when you feel ready, slowly bring your attention back into the room and into your body. Slowly begin to wiggle your fingers and toes. And when you feel ready, slowly open your eyes. Okay, well, thank you and welcome, everybody.
Thank you, Brad.
Yeah. Leslie, before we introduce Charles, did you want to say anything?
Oh no, I'm absolutely here.
Okay.
Just waiting to hear Charles.
All right. And Victoria, anything on your end there?
No, same with me.
Okay. All right, great. Well, I've been thinking for a while how to introduce Charles, because the truth is everybody on this call knows Charles. I know that probably everybody has actually attended one of our events where Charles has either spoken or we've been reading Charles's books. So I'm not going to take a long time to introduce you, Charles, but for those who might not know, Charles is an author and a public speaker, and he describes himself as a degrowth activist. And I've also heard him described as a change agent. And he's author of several books, including The Ascent of Humanity and Sacred Economics and The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, which of course was the recommended reading for today's session. And so I just want to add to this introduction that we met Charles four or five years ago. And Charles, has just been delightful for us to watch your important work growing and blossoming in the world. And I know you're traveling all over creation all the time. I don't know how you do it. And we're watching you spread the light, spread the message of truth and non-separation, which is just makes our hearts sing. So we know how busy you are, and we're deeply grateful that you took the time to join us today. So thank you for joining us, and welcome.
Thank you, Brad. I've been looking forward to it.
When you and I spoke the other day, we were talking about this class, and
yeah,
you told me I was sharing with you a little bit about the forum, so you knew more or less what, you know, the trajectory we're on here and what our group has been discussing, what we've been reading and watching and so forth. And you were very excited and you said, "Oh yeah, I've had some new insights about tipping points and near-term extinction, but from the perspective of the Gaian mind." And I just thought that would be a perfect way to start, if you would like to begin with that.
I'll probably get to that. I have it right now to share a little story.
Yeah.
That'll probably lead there.
Great.
You've had Anna Breitenbach, is that how you say her name?
Breitenbach
on your show, and Carolyn has been on as well, yeah.
Carolyn is with us today too. She's
and
part
today
of the call.
Too, yeah. So like, you know, like all of these different, I mean, not just different perspectives, but the kind of different, emotions and feelings come up with each of these, yet they somehow fit together in some way. And I think that's kind of what will hopefully emerge from today, like a sense of this cohesive picture that includes in its cohesion the unknowing that we are entering into. I have a friend here locally. He's a former military. He is a helicopter repair person at a Air Force base, basically fixes helicopters. You know, not the prototypical person on spiritual path, but he's been going through these tremendous changes, and we've been hanging out some. And recently, he told me a story. He was driving his daughter to school, and she wanted her little. She's like, I don't know, five or something, and she wanted her little blanket. So he gave her the blanket and it had this tag on it. And when he gave her, it kind of scratched her eye a little, and it was fine. You know, she cried a little bit, but, you know, no big deal. And so drops her off at school, you know. And next thing you know, he finds out that Child Protection Services is on his case because her teacher asked, "Why are you crying?" You know, and who knows, maybe there were leading questions or something, but it turned out, you know, the way the teacher heard it was, "My daddy got angry and poked me in the eye." So, and yeah, so, I mean, this kind of thing, I don't know, like seething under the surface of our society is just, when you start looking into this kind of stuff or stop and frisk, you know, or like people who work in prisons and all the guys that are there because, I mean, it's just, you know, underneath the surface is like this seething cauldron of injustice that you can't see, you know, looking at the single family homes. Excuse me.
Bless you. Bless you.
Yeah. So anyway, so he's in turmoil, you know, like, are they going to take my daughter away from me? What's going to happen? And he's, you know, he's at work, you know, and he's just like, you know, he can't eat. He can't, he's just like in a terrible state. And after work, he just gets into his pickup truck, you know, and he's like, just like lying in there, like, you know, slumped onto the seat. And he kind of drifts off, you know, kind of, because he hasn't been sleeping because of all this, you know, he kind of drifts off. And when he wakes up, he sees the grassy field in front of him just covered with birds, this huge flock of starlings have alighted in this field. And all of a sudden it comes to him, he says, tell me if it's going to be okay. And he says the split second that he had that thought, the birds rose up in a flock, flew all around his truck so close that their wings were brushing against the mirrors.
Oh my gosh.
And the windows. And then they went back and settled again in their field.
Mm.
And he felt hugely relieved, and not only because it seemed that they answered him, but also because there was an answer out there.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
So this, to me, this is saying a couple things. One is that hold on, I'm going to ask the kids to be a little quieter out there.
Hey, guys, can you go upstairs and talk or something? Come on, the phone call. Thanks.
Yeah. So one thing, reality intrudes here. One thing.
We couldn't hear them anyway. It's okay.
Yeah, I could, though. So one thing that it's telling me, one thing, this kind of thing is happening to him as his old reality falls apart, as his old way of understanding the world falls apart, as his structures of meaning fall apart, as his identity, you know, who am I, falls apart, and he enters this place of unknowing and mystery and uncertainty. And as when these structures fall apart, the veil that obscures the real intelligence of the world gives way, and these kind of synchronicities and other communications and this engagement with this other intelligence becomes a lot more available. So here we have, you know, I don't think anybody on this call is unfamiliar with the dimensions, the magnitude of the crisis before us. Near-term extinction is one of the phrases that comes up. And the more you dig down, at least this is my experience, the more that we dig down into how bad are things, the more impossible it seems. And in fact, it is impossible according to what we've learned is possible, according to the world as we've received it, according to the theory of change that has been given to us. It is indeed impossible. It would take a miracle for our civilization to make it. And it's even, I think I remember what I was going to say about the tipping point and stuff. However, another thing that's happening as our systems fall apart is that we are learning that what we thought is possible is much, much smaller than what's really possible. We're discovering that our theory of change is based on the same story that our troubles are based on. And that story, and I guess since people have read my book, you know what I'm talking about. It's the story of the separate self in a universe of other, therefore being only as secure as the force that you have at your disposal to guard yourself against these hostile competing others out there and the indifferent forces of nature, which is, you know, they don't care about you any more than a hurricane cares about you. It's just a bunch of stuff out there whirling around. So human progress comes through exercising greater and greater control on this whirling mass of stuff out there. If that is your worldview, and that's the worldview that we've been imbued with in this civilization, if so, then your power to affect the world is very limited. It's limited by the amount of force that you have, that you can exert, which isn't very much. Even as a collective, it isn't very much compared to the powers that be that are apparently running this planet, but who are actually much less powerful than those of us on this call, because they're more deeply trapped in their story of the world than we are. We're entering this place of uncertainty, of not knowing. Which is the empty space in which a new story can grow. So you know, this despair, I think, is part of the breakdown of our limiting beliefs. I don't think that it can be skipped, really. I mean, maybe some people never have to go there because they're already born. I'm meeting a lot of young people like that, you know, people who are born so firmly grounded in the new story that they don't even feel despair because they know that that's not the way that the world works. But most people in my generation, this exhaustion of what we thought was practical and realistic, like that hitting the wall of this is not enough, that's part of the breakdown process that truly opens us up to more potent ways of creating and causing change. But even those phrases aren't quite right, because it's not that we have, you know, mastered some more powerful force that we wield and mold the world to our conception, more powerful than bulldozers and nuclear power plants. It's that we become participants in a more powerful force, in a more powerful intelligence. And realizing also, even if, you know, it's a very intimate kind of participation because it's not really separate from ourselves. But anyway, the despair, the sense of futility, hopelessness, and giving up is unavoidable. And I think that if we try to bypass it with maybe even some of the things that I'm saying, you know, it's still going to be there waiting for us. So, but even as we go through that despair process, we're also, so that's kind of the push, you know, these breakdowns, these crises pushing us out of the world that we grew up in. We're also getting a pull because we, as the fabric unravels, we see more and more points of light that the fabric had been obscuring, and we have personal experiences like that of my friend, or we run into people who secondhand show us the way that the world really works and the presence of an intelligence outside of ourselves. And so that brings me to Anna Breidenbach.
Yeah, you got it.
Who's the significance isn't only that she demonstrates that animals are imbued with much more intelligence than we thought. it's more than just intelligence. It's more of, I would say, selfhood or beingness, that they are subjects just as much as we are and not objects. And their subjectivity may be extremely different from ours. But that doesn't make them any less a subject. And the same is true, and I'm not sure if Anna really, if she went into this, but the same is true for plants, that they have a subjectivity as well. And even for rocks, mountains, rivers, planets, suns, moons, clouds, drops of water, everything is in the new story, we understand, and this is what people like Anna are pointing to, that we're not alone in this alien universe of dead force and mass that, thanks to an accident of chemistry, has arranged itself into the semblance of beingness. But we are in a universe that's alive and sentient and conscious through and through. So it's not just a universe populated by some sentient beings, which we thought were just white males, and then we extended it to white people in general, and then we extended it to all human beings, you know. I mean, like this, the basic mindset of restricting full selfhood to beings like ourselves is quite old, and it's kind of gradually relaxing, you know. So, you know, now we accept that, you know, African Bushmen or whoever are equally subjects, equally selves, equally human, equally beings. And we didn't 100 years ago, you know, and now that is spreading beyond human beings. And people like Anna are showing that it's in animals too. And then there are people who are doing similar things with plants, just really incredible stuff in Domenher, this intentional community in Italy. Do you guys know about that one?
Yes,
we do.
Yeah, so they had this thing where they hooked up plants to some kind of, they had a way where the plants could actually open and shut doors.
And, no, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, they would let some people in and not others, and they, you know, liked babies and stuff. I can't remember exactly, but. You know, and then, you know, extending it, and so these are beings that are even less like we are. And then, you know, maybe some of you have had conversations with rocks before. I had a conversation with a rock not too long ago, and I had an experience of what it was like to be this rock. Mm-hmm. Change happening so slowly for the rock. You know, this like profound meditative consciousness. And eons of history, and here it was now worn down to this little pebble, you know, and it had once been bedrock, and then split off into a huge boulder. So it's not just, but then even more than that, these experiences of synchronicity show us that this intelligence is not only a property of objects in the universe, but it's also a property of the universe as a whole. And I think that the revolution that we're in has to go down to that level to be successful. So I look at, you know, a lot of the stuff around climate change today, and I really see just kind of a replay of the same attitudes, where basically it's like, how can we be, you know, green technology, how can we be a little bit more clever in our treatment of nature as an object of our utilitarian profiting, like our instrumental utilitarianism. You know, how can we use it sustainably? How can we not destroy it? Oh, well, let's have, you know, carbon offsets so that if we need a total amount of CO2 that's this much, so if we cut down the forest there, we can plant another one here and kind of shift it around. But there's no maybe we can offset that by seeding the atmosphere with sulfuric acid or something like that. But there's none of this, there's not an understanding that like the forest is sacred and deserving of existence and life in its own right. I was talking to a Brazilian woman who works with indigenous people down there, and she was talking about these hipsters, like these climate change hipsters. They go down there all with the best intentions, and they're going to indigenous people, and they're saying, hey, you know, these trees that you're living among, well, you know, you can get carbon offset credits for these. You have to go around and measure them at chest height, measure the girth at chest height, divide by 2, and that's the amount of credits you get for them. And you know, so they think that they're giving these people an incentive to preserve the forest. But on a deeper level, what they're doing, like before they were preserving the forest because that's where the ancestors lived, you know, because that tree was a god. And now it's because it's worth this amount of money. By bringing on that mindset of seeing the world as a source of profit, as a bunch of stuff, as objects, they are strengthening the deep foundation of our current system. So that's why, and the results eventually, you know, yeah, the tree is worth this much, but that means that if I can get more than this much, I'll cut it down for that tree. It's not enough. We can't rely on higher profits in order to save, as the motivation to save the planet. We have to come into a deep relationship with the planet as a subject, you know, as something that has beingness and that therefore is worthy of love. You know, it's I think you get what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that the kind of material that you're working with in this course, and I'm not familiar with all of it to be sure, but you know, I think in general you're I mean, I know that, you know, I know your work a bit, you know, like the work with the elephants and the lions and stuff. Like, you're really bridging what would be called spiritual and what would be called political. And that bridging is, I think, one of the most important things happening in this world today. So let me say one more thing about the tipping point. And I'm just gonna, you know, kind of go off into deeper waters here.
Feel free.
Yeah. The process that humanity is going through is not at all unusual in this universe. Many, many planets, many, many races like ours have been through this ordeal. Part of a universal process of growth, crisis, breakdown, the space between, and emergence of something new. It's the process of coming of age. And I've written about that in other books, and you're familiar with that metaphor that humanity's going through a coming of age ordeal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been set up like this for us. You know, when people say, oh, we don't have to worry about, like people say, oh, it's a misnomer that the planet is facing destruction. It's just us. The planet will be fine. That would be a lot like saying to a mother whose child is deathly ill, oh, the mother will be fine, you know, it's just the baby that's sick. It's just the child that's sick. But part of the reason that the mother is here is in order to rear this baby into adulthood, this baby species that we call humanity. And everything has been set up for us to go through this process of separation. Hundreds of millions of years ago, the oil deposits were laid down. Geological processes have erupted minerals near the surface of the earth. All of these things were used to build civilization and take us to the point that we're at now, where we are, you know, no longer able to see the planet as merely a source of resources and just to take and take and take. We've run out of room to do that. and the planet is no longer giving so willingly. It's not like the early days of oil exploration when you just prick the surface and the oil would come gushing up. You know, now we have to force it out with fracking, by pumping seawater in there, you know, digging huge pits in the earth to get tar sands. So it, but that shows that we're at a transition point. But still, like, you know, we wouldn't be able to have, we don't get a second try. If civilization collapses, you know, the easily available oil and gas and coal, I mean, that's all gone. You know, this is the one chance. This is the one time we get to go through this process, basically. So we've come to this first, this is really the first ordeal of the coming of age process that humanity is going through. Climate change is the first ordeal. But there's a lot of other ordeals ahead of us. And it seems hopeless. Looking at it, it seems impossible when you, you know, with the methane and all that stuff. But these coming-of-age ordeals are not actually designed to be impossible. The same is true in indigenous cultures that had coming-of-age processes like this that would that were intense. You know, they weren't like a bar mitzvah. You know, I mean, they were like, like you might not make it. Some of these you wouldn't make it. Like some, you know, not everybody would come back from their year-long or year-and-a-half-long ordeal. So it was for real. But most people would come back. They weren't designed to be impossible, but they were designed for there to be moments where you thought it was impossible. That's what would collapse the child ego self and open up the person to take on the adult self. There has to be a breakdown. And that's what's happening to humanity now. We're having a breakdown in our conceit, and by our I mean the dominant culture, in our conceit that we are, you know, transcending nature and rising above it and becoming its masters, and that the next technological advance will solve all our problems, and you know that self-image is being destroyed. And if all of our solutions depend on our ability to engineer ourselves out of every problem, then the hopelessness is unavoidable. So we're being, in a way, delivered from that strategy of solving our problems, from that strategy of manipulation and control. It's not working anymore. And that's where the hopelessness comes from. Because when you tap into the governing intelligence of this universe, you realize that it's not at all hopeless, that we are capable of far, far more than the Newtonian view that you are a force exerting mass on an external reality would admit. When we understand that we are interbeings, that we're not separate, that everything happening in the world mirrors something happening in ourselves, that everything that we do to another, we do to ourselves, that any relationship, any difficult relationship is a medicine that is bringing out a wound that wants attention. You know, when we break down this division between self and other, when we can look at an ISIS fighter, or whatever they're called now, an Islamic State fighter beheading someone, and no longer say, well, they're just evil and must be destroyed, but say, what would it take for me to do that? What's the totality of circumstances that caused that? You know, when we enter that state of interbeing, we realize that everything we do has cosmic significance. Every action that we take, even if it's small and invisible, has effects on the entire planet and beyond. Then it's not hopeless anymore. It's, for me, it's been a journey to trust that. And I can't say I fully trust it, but I am learning to trust it. And many, many of us are learning to trust it. And the more of us who learn to trust it, the more we signal to other people that it's okay to trust it. Because, hey, you know, you're doing it. Ah, maybe it's okay if I do it too. Maybe it's not crazy to live according to this deep-seated knowledge that is in everybody, the knowledge of interbeing, you know, the knowledge that what I'm doing with this one person right now, this you know, military friend who's going through a process, and I'm going to spend hours with this one guy, you know, that's important. Or I think sometimes of people working in hospice or working on death row, you know, spending their days and weeks and months and years just to win justice for somebody wrongly accused, and being sent to execution. And you know, the cynic says, well, how could that really help the state of the planet? You know, that's just one guy. And you know, I mean, isn't climate change much more important? It won't matter what happens to this one guy in death row if the sea level rises 50 feet, you know, and agriculture is cut in half, you know, it won't matter. But on some level, we know that it does matter. We know that when we heal separation and release ourselves from enslavement to the habits of separation and be an agent for that releasement for others, we know that it creates a morphogenetic field that loosens that enslavement everywhere on the planet. And it is precisely that enslavement that conditions us to the lifestyles of consumption and production and you know, the whole world-destroying machine. It's all tied together on every level. So we need to begin to trust that knowing. And for me, it just helps to see other people trusting it in a really deep way. I mean, one way it comes out is generosity. Another way it comes out is courage. Courage, faith, I'll be okay. I need to follow this. I will be okay. It's, you know, my first priority isn't to make sure I have enough accumulated resources and money and investments and fences and walls to make sure that I'll be okay. And then maybe if I have some left over, then I'll do some good in the world. You know, it's a shift of emphasis toward the gift. So, you know, we hold each other in this way of being through our mutual examples to each other. So this, yeah, so the coming of age that humanity is going through, to just jump back to that, it's not set up to be impossible, but it is set up to look impossible at certain key moments. In fact, the challenges ahead of us are way, way bigger than just climate change. The damage goes way deeper than that. You know, the stuff with the, like, there are things that are so far off the radar screen of the Western scientific worldview that aren't recognized in that worldview as important, but that are actually key to keeping Earth in balance. And we haven't, you know, and these are under assault as well. And they're not even on the radar screen yet, you know, but this Brazilian woman told me that the people there, they think that the real reason for climate change isn't carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases. It's that the metals are being mined out of the equatorial regions and moved to the temperate zones, and that these are key for Earth's kind of energy homeostasis, like something about the electromagnetic fields of the planet and so on and so forth. I'm not sure if they even frame it in that language, but they say you can't just take the gold away. The gold is there for a reason. You know, the minerals are there for a reason. They're part of the physiology of the planet. You take that away. And the other thing is deforestation, which isn't unrelated to CO2, of course, but that's like the communication network through the mycelia, where the whole planet communicates with itself, mm-hmm. and like a healthy body does. You know, and these are things that are, you know, a bit farther off the radar screen. And then even another step farther, you know, the elephants walking their patterns across the continent of Africa, they're doing a kind of a ritual that is, it's part of their maintenance of a healthy geo-energy metabolism. I'm not sure exactly what's that?
Stabilization.
stabilization. Oh, so you guys know about all this. I guess I'm not surprised.
Just about the elephants. We didn't know about the other part, but it's funny, as you were talking, I was just about to interject about how the elephants do their walking, and it's like literally like the blood flowing through our veins, you know, and when they can't walk because of boundaries, it stops, and that's very unhealthy for the planet. So, yeah, we know about that piece, but please go on. We didn't know about
that. Well,
yeah.
Well, I mean, well, another one is the tremendous amount of fresh water that is being pent up at higher altitudes than it wants to be through by dams, you know, and that, like, who knows what that does? You know, there are all these things that are going to need healing, and so they're going to present us with deepening levels of these initiatory ordeals as we move forward. So that's okay. And so this is, I guess, my message is that it's a normal process. It's a dangerous time. It's one that not every planet makes it through. It's for real, but it's not set up to be impossible. That the sense that it is impossible is coming from the same place that the machine is coming from. The worldview of separation and the theory of change that goes along with it. And there's one more thing also. There's a cosmic aspect to this too. Some of you may have noticed that there are lots of ETs hanging around. And I think one reason, maybe not all of the races are here for this reason, but some of them are here because they are very interested in what's going on, because no planet has ever gone as deeply into separation as we have and made it through. So if we do make it through, it's something new in the galaxy. It's an evolutionary event that has ramifications beyond just this planet. And that's why there's so much interest in what's happening. So I guess, and that's a different perspective than Earth will be fine no matter what. No matter what we do, Earth really, really cares what's going on. And there are powers inherent in the Earth that want to help, that are waiting to be asked, waiting to be invoked and worked with. And that is a kind of a technology that is very different from the control-based technologies that we're used to, where you impose something on matter. You know, it's a matter of working with matter, listening to matter. And to even do that, you have to see that matter has intelligence of its own, which is the kind of work that you guys are doing, and Anna and maybe some of the other people you've had on. Like, this is where we need to be going. And these technologies, for lack of a better word, become natural as our viewpoint changes. And we feel and we know ourselves as no longer alone. And it's scary too for me, because when I validate these perceptions, another part of me, a cynical part, thinks that I'm just comforting myself with fairy stories. That's the part that has been hurt already by the betrayal of its knowing. The child that knows that the teddy bear is, or the dolly is, a being, and then grows up to learn that it's just a bunch of rags, and that the tree is just a bunch of woody tissue, and that the rock is just a rock, and that the world outside of oneself is dead. That's such a painful process that's achieved through multiple trauma that are quite subtle and invisible sometimes, but maybe sometimes quite intense. That when something comes up that says maybe you were right all along, it brings up a lot of fear that the trauma will be repeated, that will be crushed again. And so I think you know, we might get cynical and skeptical. And I even find in a lot of like professional skeptics, the people who would debunk anything that suggests that there's intelligence outside of ourselves, they are actually longing for proof. They want to be proven wrong. And that's why they attack any crack, any hole, any possible grounds for doubt. They'll use that to debunk any, you know, anomalous phenomenon, because what they want is certainty. They want certain proof, and so their debunking is kind of actually a search for certainty. Unfortunately, there is no objective road to certainty. They have to actually have an experience. And then you don't need proof. Although for me, even after I have an experience, I still doubt and I want more experiences. Those are my medicine, my food. They keep me believing. Because the world that I still live in, the news, you know, it's all firmly grounded in the old story. So I think, Brad, maybe I'll turn it back over to you, and you can ask questions or we can do whatever.
Okay, great. Well, gosh, thank you, Charles. It was a beautiful talk you gave, and deeply resonates with me, and I know Victoria and Leslie, too. I'm sure I'm speaking for you and everybody on the call. I think we'd like to open it up to sharing and questions and answers from the group. So please be thinking about what you might want to say or questions you want to ask Charles or whatever. And I guess meanwhile, Charles, I just wanted to say a couple things is while people are thinking of what they want to ask you. You've touched on one of the key themes for the forum, and that's the polarity of hope and hopelessness. And we sort of dance around this, and you know, we keep coming back to the same place, which is the place where Carl Jung says, you know, to hold the tension between the two sides, which allows space for a third option to manifest. Third possibility, which of course is the miracle. You know, it's the tipping point. It's the miracle. It's the thing we can't think of. So, while people are sort of percolating on what they want to ask you and share about, is there anything else you'd like to say around this particular issue? For example, do you have advice for people when you do your workshops, if people ask you, you know, what they do when they're in hopelessness, do you have advice for them?
What to do when you're in hopelessness?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's a state that people can get out of under their own efforts. And I think that to turn it into something that you should do something about actually kind of deepens the hopelessness sometimes. When I'm delivered from hopelessness, it's usually by something irrational. You know, it could be like when a baby smiles at me, you know, or it could be a chance encounter I have with, like that story that I told you about that guy in the pickup truck, you know, and the birds, like that was a medicine for me. You know, it kind of, I you know, visit this place of hopelessness quite often, you know. In fact, I do it on purpose. I'll read, you know, leftist websites or something like that.
What kind of websites?
Leftist.
Oh, leftist. Okay.
Yeah. You know, like political, like Counterpunch or something like that.
Right. Right.
Because I like to know why it hurts, you know, without coming into, well, that's a whole other story, but Yeah, I think that it's something from the out, like there are certain in the whatever spiritual journey in the, you know, evolutionary process, there are certain states in which you can, you know, make efforts and make progress. And there are others where it's not, where it's totally not up to you. Mm-hmm. And your role is like a baby being born, you know, and there's the, I mean, so suppose like, suppose you ask that question of a fetus. You know, the fetus asks you, what should I do? I'm hopeless, you know, like I can't get out of here, you know, it's really tight now. Used to be great in here, but now I'm cramped, you know, what should I do about it, you know? Like, well, you know, it's going to get a little worse, you know, you're going to start getting squeezed and pushed, you know, and what are you going to do about it? Well, you know, the mother is doing the work, mm-hmm. almost all the work, mm-hmm. although it's also true that it's much easier to deliver a live baby than a stillborn. Mm-hmm. So the baby's life force, which manifests as its struggles, you know, it's pushing, it's squirming and wriggling, its response to this process, that's important too. So basically the advice is be alive. Just be alive and you'll know what to do at the right moment. But even that might not even might be misleading. So instead of, you know, giving like advice on here's what to do when you're in despair, I think it's like just by framing it like this, for example, it injects something new into that person's psyche. So it could be by this kind of meta framing that I'm doing now. It could be an encounter or an experience that someone has, or it could be a story that someone tells them. And without it translating into a to-do directly, the person, by taking in this new data point, is changed into somebody who will do something different, or maybe who no longer feels that despair for some reason, or maybe the despair is still there, but somehow, you know, I just don't care right now. Yeah, the planet's doomed, et cetera, et cetera. Like someone may not be intellectually convinced otherwise. You know, their intellectual opinion might still be that it's hopeless, but for some reason they just don't feel that paralyzing hopelessness because some other thing entered into their matrix of self, you know, into their being that they're just not in that place at that moment. So I think that the best thing we can do is to offer other people this medicine, just as we are offered this medicine when we need it, you know, and we take care of each other. We hold each other. It's like the way it's been is we've been like swimmers in this stormy sea, gasping, you know, occasionally coming up for air and into this breathable, light-filled realm, you know, just for enough of a gasp, and then we get plunged back into the waters of separation again, and we come back up again, and we can't stay up for very long under our own power. But what's happening now is that every time we come up, there's other people who are up too, and they hold us up for a little while longer. And we catch our breath, and we're able to hold other people up for a while longer. And so what's happening now is we're getting like a whole mat of people holding each other up above the surface, so that now, you know, it's not as it had been for many of us, decades and decades of drudgery and kind of this muted despair with a few moments, you know, a transformational seminar here, an inspiring book there, religious experience somewhere else where we're above the water, but then sinking back down, you know, into the world of your rent and your mortgage and your medical bills and your car insurance and your, you know, like life in the machine, and then you come up again. Like that's how it was for a lot of us. But now it's changing because the number of people who are spending a lot of their time above the surface has reached a kind of critical mass. And so you come up and now you don't sink back down anymore because there's enough of us holding each other above. So it's really not, you know, a what should I do if I'm in despair. It's more of, yeah, it's not prescriptive like that. There's not, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Sure do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is you need to be with it. You need to be in the emotion. You need to feel it. You need to go down there. And like the analogy you gave before, of the, you know, the native tribes initiations, they have to go and experience facing their own death. And
yeah,
only through doing that, only through facing our death, only through facing the despair and the annihilation and all that stuff down at the bottom of the downward spiral, that then we can come through into another part of ourselves. That's the only way the miracle is going to happen. The only way the tipping point will happen is if enough of us are willing to do that and go down and grapple with the shadows and then, you know, transform it and come up, you know, feeling it and then coming up into a new space, new consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I used to say, you know, just sit with it, be with it, give it space. Mm-hmm. And I think that is often good advice, but it also, like, it kind of subtly turns it into this, you know, this thing you're supposed to do right, you know?
Yeah, it's like a subtler level of control. And,
yeah.
And you can't go through the initiation trying to control it. You won't. I mean, that is the point. You have to give up the control. So, yeah, some of those techniques, quote unquote, are a subtle way of still trying to control, holding on to the control. And that control impulse is a really major part of the old story. So I love that initiation analogy, the way you described it, Charles. I think it's really helpful, because when somebody takes an initiation, they do know they're taking an initiation. They don't know what's going to happen, but they do know they'll be challenged, and they know it's an initiation. So
yeah,
for people to have that understanding right there, I think that's enough.
And even like to take it even another level, like, so that could even turn into a piece of advice, well, surrender to it.
Right, right.
But that also becomes a doing. Like,
exactly.
Like,
exactly.
The fact is that you will have moments that are so overwhelming that you will have no choice but to be with it.
Exactly. So
and you will have experiences that will surrender you to it.
Yes, yes.
And you can't take a shortcut. You can't say, you can't, like, preemptively surrender.
Yeah,
what
exactly.
You will do, if you do that, is you will have a pretend surrender that will not fool the administrator, the cosmic administrator of your ordeal.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're saying. It's like surrendering would be a subtle way of trying to control it. So it's ripping off all possibility of control by the experience, making it happen.
And when the real surrender happens, you just know that it's real.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it.
Like, yeah.
You know, you just, like, wow, I've surrendered.
You know? I was forced into it.
And I think, like we got to let go of this kind of personal achievement mindset that is imbued in us by our culture and that we then translate onto spirituality. What we need is humility, which, again, if I call for humility, again, it becomes something that we strive for. I guess really what I'm saying is that in this particular part of the passage, spiritual advice doesn't help when it's prescriptive. Mm. But perhaps telling the right story helps.
Yeah.
You know, or perhaps...
Or coming up above the surface of the water and seeing everybody around you and being buoyed up by that helps, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah,
experiencing generosity, you know.
Yeah.
I gave a talk recently at, it was called the Henry Nouwen Lecture. He was this Catholic theologian who just really, really lived the gospel. You know, he just you know, gave away everything. He gave up, a tenured faculty position at Harvard in order to take up an unpaid position at, like, a home for disabled people. You know, like, he was just doing stuff like that. And his generosity and selflessness impacted people profoundly. even if they never read his books or anything, it those things provide a data point that doesn't fit into the worldview of separation, which includes, everybody's in it for themselves, and it's okay to give, but not beyond, your calculable needs, and it's not okay to let go. Like, someone like that is like a living exception to reality, and it says, you can do it too. It says, reality isn't real. So I think that, all of us have the power to do that in big and small ways, to be this disruptor of the story of separation through, I was just with somebody, he's like this famous guy, knows Obama, impeccably dressed, like power elite kind of guy. And the way that he treats the janitors, and the people doing menial labor is so, it's disruptive because he looks them in the eye, he speaks to them like as an equal, and kind of breaks the story that they're, excuse me.
Bless you.
Like even little things like that, to relate to someone as human who's not accustomed to being seen as a human. Thank you for the work you do. When you're talking to the driver of the shuttle bus, any human connection. I mean, so I think these things invalidate the logic of despair in could be small ways, but sometimes a small encounter like that has huge effects on someone's life.
And Charles, you're making such a brilliant point. And, this is also one of the things that we keep coming back to in our work with the forum. And I would just call it love. It's, all these things that we can do to express our love and to feel the love, that also breaks our, it breaks things open. It stops the old story, as you call it, and it opens a path for a new way. To look a janitor in the eye or the shuttle bus driver, whoever it is, the waiter, and say, thank you, and really mean it, and really pour your love into that person and feel the love when you're talking to them. That makes all the difference in the world. And if enough people were doing that, imagine what a world it would be.
And what enables someone to do that is when they're filled with love.
Exactly.
So again, it's not an exhortation.
Right.
And what you're doing in your work on these calls in this forum, like you're creating a space where people step into it and they're filled with love.
Mm.
And then we all go out from this space full of love, and maybe the little suggestions help. But it's really like it becomes who we are. It becomes second nature. You walk out of these whatever inspiring, love-filled space you're in, and you become a vehicle of that. That's 90% of it, I think.
I agree with you. Thank you for saying that, because that's really the intention behind this. This is so much of what we do. So thank you for seeing that and speaking about that.
Yeah, because otherwise, you go to these seminars, conferences, retreats, and there's like that cynical part again. It's like, well, okay, I just spent 5 days in a retreat with a bunch of really nice people, and that was great and all, but, we didn't solve any of the problems of the world. We didn't organize an organization. We didn't affect the power elite. In the world of force and mass, it accomplished nothing. But these actually are really important because they are immersions in a new story, immersions in interbeing, immersions in love. And those experiences live inside of us, and they become part of us, and they fill us, I mean, it's not an all or nothing thing, but I come out of those seeing the world differently and acting differently and being like this, you know, love dynamo myself. So I think these are really important. Yeah.
So I think you need to add that to your online bio. You just say you're a love dynamo.
Yeah, I'm not sure where degrowth activist came from. I think that was written for, like, specifically for, you know, some kind of sacred economics event or something.
I found that if you Google Charles Eisenstein, it's what comes up.
Really? Ah, I see.
But, you know, I, just to wrap up the conversation about love, I just feel like, when you're faced with mass extinction, what other response could be more appropriate? Really, the only appropriate response is to love. And, you know, that's what it's about. That's what we're here for. That's who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So to know that, to know that we're that, and to express that and live it and be it and feel it, the more we can do that, the more we've gone through that initiation that you're describing personally.
Yeah.
Come out the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So, Victoria, are there any hands up or comments on the Q&A board?
Yes, there are. There's that one hand up, and there is one comment on the Q&A board. I'm wondering if Leslie wants to say anything before we call on anybody.
I muted her mic for her. She was just, hold on just one second.
Her mic looks unmuted because it keeps lighting up at her neck.
I unmuted it.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm not media savvy at all. What were we talking about? I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
Leslie's in deep meditation today.
Okay.
Maybe it's best if I keep quiet.
Okay, I just wanted to know, it looked like maybe you were trying to say something. Before calling on anybody, I wanted to take your hand.
Oh, okay. No, I just loved every word of this. I love the way you present things, Charles. It's very different from my own way of seeing, but actually we see the same things.
Yeah.
So I reveled in your language and your presentation. It was stunning. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
Thank you, Leslie. Totally
agree with that, Charles. Absolutely. I love that story too. I think that story that you started off with, it in some ways just ties it all together, because it was so brilliant. And you're right. I'm experiencing with people that I deal with is that those kinds of experiences are happening more and more to people who are not necessarily on a conscious spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
I can see
that. But he certainly is now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
that was an interesting one.
Those are powerful invitations, you know, not only to the person they happen to, but to the people who hear the story too, you know, because it's like, okay, Charles, what world are you living in here? You know, either it's a world where, you know, some, slightly PTSD ex-Marine, you know, made up a story and, right, or it's a world in which like this magical thing happened.
Magic, yeah.
And and if that's true, if that happened, then what else can happen? You know, like it's telling me something about the nature of reality and the world that we live in. It's a communication, and I can shut my ears to that communication, but why would I? You know, and like it's not like I might, you know, fool myself into thinking that I'm making decisions based on evidence and forming beliefs based on evidence, but I mean, oh my God, like, you know, like you could feel the energy of that story. You could feel, and I just love getting these repeated invitations to really stand in what I know to be true, but have trouble believing.
The more beautiful world my heart knows is possible.
Yeah, our hearts know it, but our minds don't.
Oh, they're catching up.
Oh, those
they need to get educated.
Yes.
Capacity mind. Anyway, okay, we now have two hands and we have one comment on the Q&A board. So unlike usual, why don't we start with the Q&A question? I understand what Charles is saying, experiencing the world from a place of interbeing. And I also feel the despair at a profound level over the way things seem to be. What I don't see is how the masses of those living in the old paradigm can move into the new sense of being. Feels like maybe we've sort of already answered that, right?
I don't know. I'd like to say something about that.
Okay.
I mean, part of the despair is that the masses will never change, so my changes aren't enough. Which is basically coming from, well, I'm separate from the masses, I don't want to say that the person who asked this question is, you know, that dim, but, you know, like that, you know, as I begin to understand that everything, every, you know, darkness or ignorance in the masses mirrors a darkness and ignorance in myself, then I realize that my evolution will change the masses too, or will correspond to changes in the masses too. And how do the masses change? They change the same way I change, which is that my old story of the world, my own system of meaning, my own identity stops working for me. And I'm born. There's a death and a birth. That's what an initiation ordeal is, and that's happening for a lot of people right now. And as our global systems and stories and normalcy breaks down, it's going to happen to a lot more people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is how it has to happen. I don't see any other way of it happening. And that means that the dark age, you know, that one might think would follow this breakdown need not be nearly as dark as it would seem to be inevitable, because when you have like so many people entering into this kind of spiritual space of healing, like my local friend is, you know, I mean, you know, very, very different outcomes are possible. Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
And the word spreads when something different is being seen and understood and manifested. People tell those stories because they're so interesting. Gosh, guess what happened today, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets passed on, you know, into the family over dinner or something. And
over the internet, on Twitter.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, he's reluctant to share it. I mean, you know, the guys he works with, they're like the toxicity of the military base, and he was just telling me about it the other day. It's just, you know, it would curl your teeth. You know, like he goes in there with a, you know, he had long hair originally, you know, and they're like, you know, like, I mean, just like in the most like disparaging, you know, hey, hippie boy, you know, smoking some weed, you know, like just like, you know, the most like it's just so dysfunctional, you know, and everybody's out to get each other and like.
Very programmed.
Yeah. So like, I understand the despair. Like, I mean, I'm not like living in a bubble. I read the news. I mean, you know, the Lisa Renee talks about this bifurcation. I don't know if you guys ever listened to her.
I know her, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, like people are kind of like whole groups of people are devolving into these group reality bubbles of total insanity. I mean, you see it in the political right in America, you know, these just like hate-filled mini universes that are self-reinforcing. You know, you don't even have to go to the right. I mean, geez, like all the stuff in the Middle East, you know, this is a product of bombing people for 20 years.
Right.
Like, what do you expect when one of my friends was in Iraq right before 1992, the first invasion, and she's like, yeah, it wasn't a perfect society. You know, it was politically repressive, but everybody had free universal medical care, free universal higher education, you know, almost full employment, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It was a functioning society. You could get on the bus, you could go to work, you know, the trains were running, you know, like there was food in the supermarkets, et cetera, et cetera. And now, like, after, you know, 20 years of bombing and occupation and stuff, like everything is in tatters. I mean, imagine if that happened here, you know, you'd be full of, and why, you know, like she talked about, this is Jody Evans, this world-class hell-raising activist, you know, she said she was in Afghanistan or Pakistan, you know, talking to a Pashtun elder in this village, you know, so remote that they didn't even know what the United States was. And he just came back from his home was attacked by a predator drone, and his son, who had just come back from his education and was taking up a teaching position at the village school, he just got back from peeling strips of his son's flesh off the wall in order to bury him. His son and his brother had been, you know, blown into unrecognizable pieces, and he was peeling them off the walls to bury them. And he had never even, you know, the United States is like this nebulous concept. I mean, he's living in this ancient world, you know, and like that kind of stuff happens. Like, and then, you know, extremists are born, you know, we call them extremists or terrorists or whatever, like, you know, and you look at the news and there's just not a hint of that. And instead there's this kind of, you know, mass psychosis, and fear, you know, about terrorism and you know, and it's all part of the war on evil. This whole this is one of the viruses that, you know, infects our civilization. That our progress comes through defeating evil, whether in ourselves or outside of ourselves. Anyway.
But Charles, they have to conjure the evil first and then deal with it, you know? There really isn't any evil. It is all manufactured. And they're not everyone knows that, but many of the people who do the conjuring know that they are deliberately setting up something that doesn't really need to happen.
Yeah, it's hard for me to get into their heads sometimes.
Yes, I like, know. What, I work with it all the time. It makes me crazy.
Yeah.
Go ahead. V, is there another question? Do we have?
There are two hands up. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm just looking at the time, and I'm just trying to move things forward a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. And I was only going to say that because I'm a little bit familiar with Lisa Renee, and I know the bifurcation that she's talking about is very, or bears a similarity to what we talk about, what Leslie talks about, that this is the time of, you know, that there's sort of, people are kind of going in two directions.
Right.
It's a kind of a, you know, you can talk about a metaphor of the wheat from the chaff or whatever, but it's like beings who need a certain kind of experience are going in that direction, and beings who are here to ascend into a different kind of experience, the more beautiful world experience, are this initiation is to sort of allow those who want to go in that direction to have the experience that will birth that experience, you know, to birth that in them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Leslie uses the analogy of the wheat, kind of the separating of the wheat from the chaff, as a similar way of discussing it.
Mm. Yeah. Let's move on, because I could say a lot about that. But
yeah. Okay, so the first hand that went up.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
I can't grieve for the planet. That's of no help. A very, very dear friend who came to see me once said to me, I thought she was looking quite ill, and I was worried for her. And she was not doing well. And I looked at her, and I said, you know, I'm really worried for you. And she said the best thing, piece of advice that's carried me a long time, is she said, I don't need your worry. What I need is your belief and your support that I am well and I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that has stayed with me a lot of years, because when we project the worry, when we project that this can't be done or what if it can't be, then that's the energy that the planet is picking up and that other people are picking up.
Like, I agree with about that worrying about somebody doesn't serve them and in fact kind of pulls them down into the space of worry, and they need then to take care of your worry in addition to taking mm-hmm. care of your own healing. But there's something about grief that I find really important. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who's telling me about this woman he met in Africa who was like the happiest woman in the whole tribe, you know, just like so jolly and radiating joy. And he said, "How is it that you're so happy?" And he said, "It's because I cry a lot." Mm-hmm. So like I recently participated in a grief ritual. And I thought I found it really healing. You know, it's not like, it's almost like in order to be like really free and clear in my joy, I have to have, you know, moments where I'm really deeply in grief too. And otherwise, if I don't go there, then the grief is kind of like latent underneath, you know, and colors everything. But if I can just really get into it and like weep for what is lost, you know, and let it hurt, then that pain has been felt, you know, and that's what it wants. It wants to be felt and released, you know, that wound of separation, you know, that I mean, it hurts down in there. And mm-hmm. and when it's released to the surface, then it no longer colors everything. And I think one reason why we have such like an addicted culture is that the pain is diffuse. So it hurts all the time. So anytime you're left alone with yourself, that's called boredom. It's uncomfortable. And so we crave anything to take us away from ourselves. And it's because we haven't really gone in and felt what is asking to be felt. And instead we kind of push it into the future, you know, we pave it over, we narcotize it, and then that hurting thing is like, darn it, I'm going to have to manufacture another situation in order to be felt. And so it keeps happening and happening. And I think, yeah, paradoxically, like people who are wallowing in this paralyzing grief and despair, it's maybe because they haven't felt it enough in like, and it's not their fault. I mean, our society doesn't have, you know, these processes for the public, you know, community holding of grief. But I am drawn to that kind of work, actually.
We do.
And I don't think what you're saying contradicts it, you know.
We do try to protect people from it.
Yeah.
And we're each entitled to it. It's part of our journey. It's what we have to feel. What we need are people who aren't going to sit there and worry that something's wrong with us because we're doing that or because we're experiencing that. Charles, I really, really, truly appreciated every word you said. I look forward to hearing you all over again in the replay. Thank you so much for all that you've brought to this and for the verbiage, the languaging that I really have been needing, and thank you for that. Okay.
Really good. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, we have one more hand, which is Carolyn. So, Carolyn, you've got the mic.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we
can. Yep. Hi, Carolyn.
Okay. Hi, Charles. Welcome to this forum, and I'm so deeply touched by your remarks and so appreciative of what you're saying today. Two things in particular. One is your story about the military guy and how it resonates with my story in the moment with a homeless guy that I've been connected with for about 6 months. And, you know, I don't know how, if at all, this relationship will change him. I know how it has deeply impacted me and caused shifts as I've been processing it. And so, you know, I just have to trust that is making a difference for the planet somehow. Mm-hmm. I feel it has to be. And mm-hmm. the other thing is, I want to thank you so much for what you said about grief work. I don't know who you had the grief ritual with. I'm pretty sure the guy you were talking about who was commenting on the woman in Africa would be Francis Weller.
Francis Weller, yeah. It could have been him, yeah.
Yeah. And and I also gave a presentation for the Metaphysical Forum a few months ago on grief, and I'm doing grief workshops regularly because people are really needing that. And I know that for myself, the deep grieving has just moved me into two things that are invaluable. One is connection with others and with nature, and the other is into deeper joy. You know, paradoxically, more joy than I could possibly imagine. So I so appreciate that you're there with me in that. And thank you so much for being here and for all you've given us today.
Yeah, thank you, Carolyn. The homeless, working with, like, you know, a relationship with a homeless person, that's such a good example of something that the 3D logic says. I mean, if anything, you're making the world worse because homeless people don't consume very much, but if he gets rehabilitated, his carbon footprint's going to go way up, you know? But like you're saying, like you have this feeling that is undeniable that what you're doing is important, that relationship is important for the planet.
Yeah.
And I refuse to live in a universe in which that feeling is an illusion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like Sherry was saying, like if I'm wrong, then so be it. At least I enjoyed living this way.
Absolutely.
Well, let me just interject something here. Carolyn's been updating us now and then on her relationship with this homeless person, and the stories that are coming out of this relationship are so amazing. And Carolyn, when is you're writing a book about it? I know. When is the book going to be ready?
Well, I don't know that the book is going to happen. I've actually talked with him about it, and I've let him read parts of the manuscript, and they're pretty disturbing to him. So out of love, I'm just putting it on the back burner for right now, and if I'm meant to write the book at some point, I will. But I'm writing my own book within my own heart, and the way it's impacting me, and I'm trusting impacting the planet, and undoubtedly impacting him. That's what matters.
Yeah, can I say something about that, actually? You know, because another part of the, you know, 3D model is that in order for something to have a big impact, you have to kind of scale it up. You know, you have to write a book about it, make a film about it, you know, make it viral, make it scalable, and otherwise it's just not worth very much.
Right.
And the result of that, like, that's really disempowering for a lot of people, because not everybody can do a big thing, you know, and be out in front. Like, most people are going to spend their lives doing small, humble things.
Yep.
And so we actually need to be, you know, empowering those things, not devaluing them. And the other thing is, like, I find when, like, sometimes I'm involved in planning events and stuff, and I find that when there's an intention from the very beginning to make it into this, you know, big spectacle, that it takes the authenticity out of the event itself.
Yes.
You know, and the ones that actually do end up having a big impact are the ones at the beginning, they had no clue that anyone was ever even going to find out about the project. But then, like, through, you know, a series of synchronicities, somehow word gets out anyway.
Yeah.
And even if that doesn't happen, that we have to trust that feeling you're talking about, that like, anything we do tugs on invisible threads that send ripples out through the matrix of causality that is not linear and is not based on force, you know. And I find that when the more I trust that and live by it, the more the unexpected happens. You know, the things that I couldn't have contrived end up happening, and I'm just kind of carried in this, you know, in this tide. And I just having this conversation is inspiring me to really, you know, reconnect to that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Yes, thank you, Carolyn.
And we have one more hand.
Charles, thank you so much for your words. I'm just full up. And I just wanted to make a comment about love. And I, for the last 2.5 years, I live on the island of Kauai, and it is the ground zero for
the agricultural chemical companies testing pesticides and mm-hmm. and doing research. And so I got involved doing writing an amendment that was to be on the ballot this last November, or November 4th. And we worked on it for 2.5 years. So I really got involved. I've never been an activist formally until this time, and it was excruciating, and we got put down twice by the county, and our ballot did not, you know, we collected all the signatures, the people wanted it, but there were ways that it got stopped. And so I spiraled down and was so disillusioned about the system, and I just recognized, and I knew this before, that there's no change that will occur that will really change things for humanity unless we change our consciousness. And then how does that go about? And I just kept asking, you know, show me what's going to make a difference here. I can't do this. I can't do it this way. It's not going to work. It's ridiculous. And, you know, what came through was love. Love is mm-hmm. what's going to make the difference. And so I have been being with that, and everything I do at this point is the foundation must be love. And so recognizing that I'm a loving being and that I'm divine, but I also have to tell myself that, you know, it's like unprogramming myself. And so putting that out. But as I do that and as I share that with others, it's like you, I think you said it in some way, that it just ripples out. And that is what's making the difference. And so I just needed to share that because it's so profound mm-hmm. for me.
I think that serving love can have expression through anything that we're doing, even if it's, you know, a political campaign.
Yes.
It can be the secret agenda behind the campaign. And often the secret agenda behind the campaign is actually hate, or it's the main strategy. So, like, a lot of, like, I was asked, you know, Charles, can you go speak at the March Against Monsanto? And I was like, no, because, like, your basic strategy is to arouse so much anger and hatred against, you know, Monsanto and the Koch brothers or whoever, that you know, we rise up and tear them down.
That's right.
And it's part of, like, the mentality of overcoming evil, again, like this kind of, you know, Leslie was talking about, you know, you manufacture this convenient receptacle of evil and then you destroy it, which would be fine if the real problem were evil, if the real problem were the bad guys at Monsanto. But if they're not the real problem, then you're wasting your time.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that, and I've been talking, you know, I've been making some relationships now with people in the activist world and trying to get this idea out there. Like you could have a campaign, which maybe isn't even the right metaphor, it's a military metaphor, but you could have a campaign where, like, the subtext and the strategy is love, you know, something like, you know, gee, Monsanto guys, I know that you really want to do the right thing. And it sure, you know, looks, and there's a lot of pressure on you, but like, you know, like that kind of language, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, I think that, well, Jody again was telling me about, she was in Ferguson, you know, and she was like, okay, we're going to, you know, use the technology of story. We're going to try your idea, Charles, you know. And so she described a scene where this African-American grandmother, you know, confronting police, you know, everybody's like tense, right? And she just tells her stories, you know, how she's afraid that her grandchildren won't come home, you know, et cetera, telling these stories. And then Jody notices that, like, some of the police are crying. And that's such, like that, in a way, it's a miracle that there hasn't been more violence there than there's been. And it could be because of, like, things like that underneath the surface, you know, that change people's views without overcoming them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I, you know, maybe someday you'll get, you know, involved again in some of these agricultural issues, and I mean, I think that the strategies and tactics of hate and arousing so much anger that, you know, we destroy the enemy, I think that those are failing.
Yes.
Look at our planet. We've been trying that for a while.
That's what I came to. I said, my God, we've been doing the same thing for thousands of years. It's not working.
No.
So back to basics.
But then, when sometimes I'll talk to people and they're like, Charles, you're just naive. You just don't understand how evil these folks are, how ruthless, how duplicitous, how manipulative, they're psychopaths. Did you guys have Andrew Harvey on this forum?
Yes. Andrew's going to be our guest speaker in January.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, he has some of these issues. We've had conversations about that were pretty interesting. So anyway, but I'm offering my viewpoint, which is, I think it has at least some truth and some usefulness in it, at least to like expand our, imaginary of the kinds of strategies we can use.
Absolutely.
We would subscribe to your viewpoint, Charles. Absolutely. It's all about the love.
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful to hear you sharing what you've come to. I'm just so happy to know that you've come to this place. It's beautiful.
Thank you, Brad.
Yeah.
It is beautiful. And it's just like what you said, Charles, that this can be used in the action of the legislature, what's going on, because it's what we're seeing is separation. And as you've been speaking, what we know is that we have to come together. Unity is a must at this point. So it's like, okay. And all the despair and, I even got depressed, which is unusual for me. When I came through that and, really sat with it and then came through it, it's like, okay, so this is what we have to do, and it's about unity and coming together. And then I have to say, I'm having so much fun.
Uh-huh.
Even looking at and knowing what possibly could happen and might happen and may happen, all of that. It's like, well, here we are now. Here we are right now. So this is it. So let's be here and let's be together. And there's a great deal of joy. So
it's the inevitable result of a major initiation.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I hope your initiation is contagious.
Thank you. I think so. I think it is. I'm seeing, because when we become that, then guess who shows up? Other people who are that too.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then, that's just it's really amazing. It's really amazing, and it's what is. And so this is really helpful for me, because we know the other story. We know where we came from and what we were told and how we were programmed, and that still is available to check into, and you go, oh my God, and then you have to remember again who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a dance. So thank you all so much.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Thank you. Beautiful. Okay, well, we have no more hands, and it is a few minutes after noon. We do have one or two things on the Q&A board, but not sure if we have time for that. We might have to take them in caucus, huh?
Yeah, we can do that. I know we're running out of time here. We need to do our ending guided meditation, and there was one little thing that we wanted to mention. We mentioned it at the retreat this past week, so some of you on the call heard us talk about it, but we came across, let's back up. Do you all remember was it last month or the month before, we posted a video on Caucus called Radioactive Wolves, and it was a PBS documentary about an hour long that talked about how scientists are studying what's happening in Chernobyl 28 years after the fire there, and how the levels of radioactivity are off the charts there. There's still extreme levels of radioactivity, and yet somehow nature is thriving, and somehow it's become a haven for endangered species, and somehow things are, you know, there's a miracle basically happening there. It's a great mystery to the scientists. They don't know how to describe what's going on. They don't know what the answer is, but it's happening. And so a friend of ours, a Russian healer who was here in town, old friend of ours, before we saw that movie, the week before we saw it, he also brought up Chernobyl out of the blue, and he said, did you hear that there are people living there who are doing well? And we said to Misha, well, how can that possibly be? The radioactivity is off the charts. And he said, it's all about the mind. It's all about the mental attitude and what people believe is going to happen. And they decided that they weren't going to get sick. And I kind of said, that's really wonderful. And I didn't say this, but I just thought, well, I don't really believe you 100%. I'd really like to see an article or something. So I asked him, I said, well, if you come across, an article about that or a video or something that describes what you're telling us, could you please send it to us? So just last week, he sent us this article that was in the UK Telegraph, just came out last week, and it's called The Women Living in Chernobyl's Toxic Wasteland. Decades after Chernobyl's nuclear disaster, despite the severely contaminated ground, government objections, and the deaths of many fellow, quote, self-settlers, a community of determined babushkas remains. Babushkas are grandmothers, basically. So there's this community of very old women in their 80s and 90s even, who are living there in Chernobyl, and they're thriving in a certain kind of way, whereas the people who had been relocated to other places, other nearby villages, those people are so depressed and debilitated from being taken away from their land that many of them have died. And so the women who are now living in Chernobyl were also people who had been evacuated, but they were so depressed. They were so unhappy about being taken off their land and being stuck in a little apartment somewhere in this depressing area with nothing. They just said, to hell with it. We're going back there. You know, we'd rather face nuclear disaster. We'd rather face thyroid cancer and whatever other diseases we might get than be depressed here. And what they're saying, these women are saying in the article, these babushkas, they're saying, well, our friends who stayed behind, they're all so depressed, they're dying. Many of them have died. But we're doing fine. We've been here many years, and we're doing fine. So anyway, the article's very, very interesting. And we posted it on Caucus, so you can go read it. I'm not recounting the entire article here, but it just felt very important to us to share that with you all, because it does feel like a good example of what we're talking about in the forum, how it demonstrates that miracles are possible. It demonstrates that science doesn't know everything. It demonstrates that that our mental attitudes, and especially that love and happiness, are so powerful, and they're powerful enough to overcome supposedly impossible conditions like these radioactive conditions in Chernobyl. These women were so in love with their land. They were so in love with the place where they grew up and raised children and farming and, raising and doing animal husbandry and all of that, that it made them so happy that they are, most of them are doing very well there. the quote that was in the article. It was so funny that she was 88 years old, and I guess the government sent troops to try to stop them from returning to Chernobyl. And she said about the group that was going, she said, "Shoot us and dig the grave or get out of our way because we're going back there." So anyway, we wanted to share this with you. Please go and read the article. And Charles or Leslie or Victoria, do you all have any comments about that before we wrap up for the day?
I guess, Brad, should this be my closing comments?
Yes, please. This would be a good time.
So, I mean, I guess I would just second all that you're saying. And probably many people in this group have had personal healing experiences, or someone you know has had an experience of healing from something that was medically incurable, supposedly, these are another one of those story disrupting data points that expands our sense of what's possible. And I think that what's possible for a human body is also possible for an ecosystem or a planet, a desert, an ocean, a lake that's polluted, the same level of healing is definitely possible everywhere. And these anomalous healings often come through, I mean, sometimes they're just like spontaneous and miraculous. Other times they come through an alternative healing modality. And all of these, there's thousands and thousands of alternative modalities now, but what they have in common is that they understand that there is an intelligence inherent in the body and in the world that isn't, so that healing isn't necessarily a matter of controlling the body better, cutting things out, using cholesterol drugs to, you know, kind of dictate cholesterol levels, or antibiotics to kill things, you know. It's not about control. It's about liberating a natural wholeness, or cooperating with a natural process. It on one level or another, they all perceive an intelligence and a consciousness and a living quality to the world outside the human mind. And I think that as we adopt the same view to nature, similar miraculous healing modalities will become available to us, for us to participate in. In fact, they already are emerging. And I'm sure that people in the group are aware of some of the things around, you know, regenerative agriculture and micro-remediation of toxic waste. And that's just the small tip of the iceberg. People are turning deserts green again without using any groundwater, and I mean, all kinds of things are happening, and you know, these aren't coming from the same technological mindset that we're used to. They're coming from a different way of seeing, a different understanding of the world, a different understanding of ourselves. And it's been really fun for me, and inspiring and joyful to participate in that with you all, in that shift. So thank you for inviting me again.
Charles, it is we who thank you. Thank you so much for your sharing and your wisdom and your humor and your radiant presence. We're just grateful to have you with us. So I'm sure we can do this again sometime soon.
Yeah, great.
Is there anything, do you have any new books coming out or workshops that you'd like to announce or anything that you'd like people to know about?
No new books coming out in the near future. Everyone probably knows my website, charleseisenstein.net. I'm giving a 5-day retreat in Bali, Indonesia.
Oh, let's go.
Weird.
So that's going to be those are really deep. Those are a deep drop, and kind of they're an immersion in the story of interbeing is what they are.
Wonderful.
Aside from that, just there's all kinds of stuff in my schedule. Yeah.
Well, plus, if people want to sign, if they haven't yet, they can go to your website and subscribe to get your emails that you send out.
Right. Yeah, I kind of do a blog, and I haven't written much for the last 2 weeks, but a couple times a week I've been writing, you know, essays and things like that.
And they're great. I love them.
They're wonderful. Charles is doing a series. There's a series called The New and Ancient Story. And
that's the name of the blog, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really wonderful stories coming out of there, fun to read, uplifting, and sort of like we've been talking about today, all kinds of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Charles. Well, thank you so much. If you need to go, we understand, and if you'd like to join us for the final guided meditation, you're welcome to stay.
I think I'm going to go now because my family's been waiting for me. But yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thanks again for taking the time to be with us, Charles.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. So we've got about 15 minutes left, and I just sort of had a little aside with Leslie here. She's meditating deeply and would prefer not to lead the ending guided meditation. Victoria, would you like to lead it?
Well, maybe we can all just join Leslie in the silence.
Sure, we can do that.
Instead of, being guided through. It gave such a beautiful centering in the beginning, and I don't know, it feels like we should just join together. Sit comfortably, close our eyes, and join together in the silence.
Okay. Well, why don't we do this? I'll just say a little closing prayer, and we can all stay on the line. At least we can hang up, but stay in meditation and prayer if you feel like doing that. And we'll be certainly doing that here. I know Leslie's in deep meditation. So if you'd like to tune in to the transmission Leslie is sharing, please do. And otherwise, we'll see you next month. It's the solstice. We're going to be meeting on December 21st, which is the solstice. And so we planned that specially. I hope it doesn't conflict with your holiday plans. We thought about rescheduling that, and then we thought, no, you know, that's such a special day. It would really be a lovely time to gather as a group. So we hope that you'll join us on the solstice, Sunday, December 21st, for the next session. Okay, so let's all just, I'll just take 2 minutes here to say this prayer. Let's all close our eyes and get comfortable. Just take a few long, deep breaths. And put our attention on the Shoshumna and just go inward now. So many wonderful ideas and sharings that have brought us out. And now let's go back within and get centered and grounded. And let's attune to the transmission that is coming through for us right now. I know it's coming from Leslie and likely also from the guides, the spiritual guides who are surrounding us in love and support. And let's just allow that in, putting our attention on the core and receiving the light and the love, the beautiful energy that's coming to us. The healing energy. And as we sink into that and go into a very quiet place inside, I'd like to just say a closing prayer. Great Spirit. Divine Mother, Mother Gaia, Father God, Father Sky, we call you in now. We thank you. We thank you for this opportunity. We thank you for the love. We thank you for the wisdom. We thank you for the healing, the inspiration, and especially for the community of each other. This opportunity to experience the separation in these separate bodies all over the planet when we're really just pretending, because we all actually are just one. We are that. We are the pure awareness and the pure love. And what a miracle that we can be here and experience this separation at this momentous time, at this unbelievable time for the planet. What a ride. So we give thanks for the roller coaster. We give thanks for this amusement park called Earth and all the other life forms that we share it with. We ask for blessings and blessings and blessings upon Gaia and upon all life forms on the Earth, and especially for each of us. Please bless us. Please fill us with the love and the inspiration so that we can go forward and share that with others who might be suffering, who might be feeling very separate. With the deepest gratitude, we offer ourselves in service and in love. Amen. Aho. And so now we can all disconnect the phones and the Skype, and please stay in meditation if you have the time, and we'll see you on the inner planes. We'll stay with you for a while. Thank you. Bless you all. Until next time.